The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
For those of you just joining us around the world, I'm Gary Knoll. My guest is Eileen Daneman, and she is here to talk about these issues. Now, Eileen, now that we're clear that we have documentation that the CDC refuses to acknowledge, talk about how they came up with zero deaths and how they look where they knew they wouldn't find the truth instead of looking where there was a chance they would find the truth.
Yes, this was quite a surprise to me. So this is the story. So a couple of months ago, and our attorney is going to find out exactly what date that was, but a couple of months ago, maybe it was 5 months ago, I was on a conference call with the vaccine people there, and Dr. Marie McCormick was on the phone call, Jeff Evans, you know, several people on the phone call from the CDC, and I articulated at that time that on the fly here, we were collecting an amazing amount of miscarriages. And so I believe it was Jeff Evans, who's one of the head of the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program liaisons between programs, said to Marie McCormick, make sure you track that. So that was the end of that conversation. So anyway, last Friday, on September 3rd, I decide to go down to the children's vaccine meeting, the advisory committee for children's vaccines, and make this presentation to show that there were upward, corrected estimates, there were upward of, 3,587 miscarriages. So as nature would have it and as the good forces would have it, I get there a little late on this Friday, and the secretary catches me, and she says, do you have any paperwork? So I says, yes, copy these documentations. So she goes downstairs and does that, and then she comes up a little late, and because it's a little late, she hands out my documentation, to the committee members instead of leaving it on the back table. So each committee member now is being handed these stats, and so just at that cosmic time, Dr. Marie McCormick is on the conference call about to make her presentation. Now, she's the chair of the H1N1 Vaccine Risk and Assessment Working Group. So she's the chair of this group that was supposed to look at all the adverse reactions and the risks and the benefits and come up with a report. So she's about to speak about, she's speaking, but meanwhile these committee members are like looking at my documentation and their mouths are open, right? And so she begins to speak and everybody thinks that her speech, her presentation is what they have in their hand because it didn't have my name on it on the front page because the secretary, put that in the middle somehow. Anyway, so they're reading this amazing documentation thinking Dr. Marie McCormick is actually articulating the same. And so she's not. And so meanwhile, they stop the meeting and they say, no, this particular report you have in your hand is for our next presenter. So she continues her little presentation, end of discussion. So meanwhile, because this was in their hand, Jeff Evans says to her, by the way, were there any adverse events for the of the H1N1 for the pregnant population? She says, and it's recorded somewhere, but what I heard, she said something about, well, we looked at VAMPS and we did this, and there are no adverse reports for pregnant women. Well, how perfect is that? Because I was about to make this presentation, and I was a set up like a volleyball player, And so I go there, make the presentation. And obviously everybody heard it, it's documented, it's recorded, end of discussion, I leave. About a week later, which was this past Friday on the 15th or the 14th, I get a call from one of the attorneys and said I should be on this next phone call conference, which was the National Advisory Committee on Vaccinations. And so I'm on the phone call. And who gets on the phone call again to make a presentation but Marie McCormick? So having gotten this documentation now twice from me, She gets on the phone call and does her same blah, blah presentation, not mentioning pregnant women. And then fortunately, some man in the committee who must have known about my documentation, sounded like an older gentleman, he chirps up and says, Dr. McCormick, were there any adverse reports for pregnant women? And she says, no. Hello?
I'm listening.
Oh yeah. So she says no report. No, this is unbelievable. So anyway, so it just so happens that last Thursday I visited Congress and it was a chill day, and so I met with a couple of aides and Dennis Kucinich, Ron Paul's office, a few people. Anyway, I have a couple of committees, the Energy and Commerce Committee and Harkin's Health Committee aide, looking into the situation. And actually, I fortunately got an email from Ron Paul's office that they want me to have more communication with them and create an inquiry letter as to, like, how this is possibly happening. Because the important point is that they have, based on Marie McCormick's, you know, falsified reports of no, can you imagine saying no adverse responses at all? And it's their own VAERS database. So I said to them on the phone, I said, how come you're not looking at your own VAERS data? I mean, it's right there.
Eileen, let us, okay, you've made your point. Now we need to look at the larger picture. And I appreciate what you have done on this. I'm going to take you back to 1976. It's a long time ago. I just finished doing, along with Robert Houston, the first major national article on the politics of cancer. And we gave it to every member of Congress. We gave it to all the major media, and nothing happened. But it was fully documented. It showed that the president's cancer advisory panel, made up of Benno Schmidt and all the top people who headed pharmaceutical companies, they decided who was going to get the money on cancer and where the direction on cancer would go. And more often than not, about 70% of the time, they awarded their own universities or their own companies the research money. Now, all this was unknown up to that point. And it really ripped. It was the first major body blow against the politics of cancer. Up to that point, it had been considered just sacrosanct. You never talked about politics in cancer. And then I would go on to do 56 cover stories on called Medical Genocide and the Public's Cancer. Again, nothing happened. Mm. I would meet with individual legislators, and they would show me great interest. I got some of this in the congressional record. There was a hearing by Molinari from Staten Island where I was able to give testimony under oath. Nothing happened. Mm. And then one day Molinari said something interesting to me. He said, don't confuse the idea that a very important issue is brought up at a committee and you have a lot of people testifying. He said that's really what Congress does when it wants to show they've covered something, but they also want to bury it.
Right.
He says nothing ever comes out of these committees in most cases when it's important. And that was a real wake-up for me, because I was believing that if you brought the truth under oath and susceptible to perjury and you had good documentation, that someone would act upon it. And then I found out from multiple legislators, Congressman Rogers, Congressman Proxmire. I met with a lot of people.
Wow.
And I was the one who helped lead, if not completely leading, in 56 separate cities, the charge against the FDA and when they wanted to control our vitamins.
Right.
And then I realized that I was fighting the wrong battle. I fought the wrong battle on cancer until I got 60 Minutes to do a piece in 2020, and then suddenly it broke out. But here is the problem, and this is as true today on vaccines. I'll give you one more example. I've been working on trying to help the Gulf War vets since 1991, when a number of vets came home who were sick and yet who had no battlefield stress. They didn't see any enemy. They didn't fight any enemy. A lot of them worked on ships. A lot of them were mechanics. A lot of them were in supply divisions. And even some combat people, really there was no battlefield problem, but yet they were sick. They had real diseases, not post-traumatic stress disorder. These were physical conditions. And then when I started investigating it, it led to a series of articles and three separate documentaries. Nothing happened. Hmm. And I met with one of the women, who herself is a Gulf War vet, and another one, Joyce Riley, very, very wonderful human being, who's really given her life to the Gulf War cause. She has seen every legislator. In fact, the other woman regularly, at her own dime, takes a bus into Washington, goes to every legislator's office and gives them more documentation, more articles, more documentations. Nothing happens, right. Whether it was Rockefeller hearings. There were four separate set of hearings on Gulf War syndrome. Nothing happened. So then, this past year, I get word that there's some Gulf War vets who are homeless. And I said, yeah, where are they homeless at? Oh, they're in Florida. I said, okay. So I drive over there with a camera crew, and they don't know I'm coming. And it's 9 o'clock in the morning, and it's boiling hot. It's like, it's in June. It's about 98 degrees, and it's very humid. And I walk in the woods, and lo and behold, I come to this little tiny pup tent, so small that a six-foot guy couldn't fit in the tent. Half his legs would be outside. And here's all these people living in these multiple little tents about 50 yards away from each other. And a lot of them are alcoholic, a lot of them are taking drugs, a lot of them are not, but they're just broke. There's no water, no sanitation, there's no food. I found one tent where there were three guys that hadn't eaten in 4 days. And one guy, it was really sad, one guy came up to me and he opened his shirt and he had two stents in there. He had just had a heart operation 2 weeks before, but he couldn't work and he had no food. He only had one can of beans. And he had his clothes folded nicely and his towel folded, and he had to walk down to the ocean to get, you know, one of those public showers at the ocean where you wash off when you come out of the ocean?
Right.
That's how he took his shower. He'd use a public toilet. And then he'd walk each day an hour and a half to get to a workplace, but when they found out he was a vet, they wouldn't give him work. He had no medicines. VA wouldn't give medicines for a heart condition. And the guy was wasting away. So I took him in, I got him his medicines, and I helped him out. And I filmed all this. And I put this up on the internet. And I wrote a little article about it. That article got on 70,000 blog sites. Yeah. And the video went viral worldwide. We're guesstimating about 30 to 50 million people watched it, and probably close to the same number read about it. Now suddenly, thousands upon tens of thousands of calls are coming in from Americans to help the vets.
Good.
Suddenly, these vets are holding rallies, and they got 400 people just this weekend coming up at one where now there's food and there's some lodging, and now there's something going to happen. For 20 years, with all the efforts of all the dedicated people exposing the truth of Gulf War syndrome, post-traumatic stress disorder, and alcoholism, abuse, and toxic drugs, and depleted uranium, and biological weapons, all the nonsense that we're able to beat, nothing happened. Nothing. Not a single governmental agency has acknowledged Gulf War syndrome is real. Show a Gulf War vet homeless, hungry, in a pup tent, and show that there are 850,000 each year who are homeless, and suddenly, boy, does that wake us up. So here's why I give you this as an extended background. Because I've been, as you know, I produced two award-winning films, Vaccine Nation and Autism Made in the USA.
Which I've seen is great, yeah.
And two things came from these documentaries. First, a lot of people in the autism field didn't want me to make the film.
I understand that.
They were trying to make their own film, and what didn't they like about my film? They didn't want to show the politics. They didn't want to show that autism is due to combinations of vaccines and thimerosal and different adjuvants.
They're still naive in thinking that they can actually have a conversation, as you say, with the congressional committees, you know, with the FDA, with the CDC. And you're absolutely right. I could slap my face.
And it went beyond that, as I would later find out. A lot of these individuals get a lot of money from the pharmaceutical companies that act as a front for the autism groups. Not all, but many.
like autism speaks.
So they want you to know how serious autism is. It is. How much patients suffer. They do. And their parents, yes, that it's not insured. Absolutely. But they want more money to go into the pharmaceutical industry so they can come up with a magic drug. And then you find out these people and their groups make a lot of money. Mm. Now, what concerns me is this. Even with my Vaccine Nation, there were many people in the vaccine movement who did not like the film. Why? Because I had good science showing for the first time Dr. Hilleman, the father of vaccine, admitting on the record just before he died that the vaccines, all the vaccines, cause cancer. And how that his friend, he says this on the film, it's right there, that his friend who was the developer of the polio vaccine, Sabin, he told Sabin, hey, we got a problem. These hamsters that were putting your vaccine into are all developing cancer. And Sabin freaked, and they covered it up. Mind you, this is a major revision of history.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And yet they didn't want this to be known. They wanted it to believe, A, that there is no connection between vaccine and autism.
Right.
That mercury is not the problem, that it's really the genetic susceptibility of the individual.
Baloney, right.
In fact, I even found one person in my organization that we have very strong evidence was there to sabotage our efforts.
Yes.
And so here's my thought. I believe that on the subject of vaccines, that we must take a completely different approach, that we've got to bypass governmental agencies completely. Forget the FDA. Forget Kucinich. I sent Dennis Kucinich my economic stimulus plan. It appeared under his name, no credit, on his website, my stimulus package.
Right.
Even my health care package, he took. That's fine. I don't care. You know. But what I do care about is that we are going to make a terrible mistake if we believe that our legislators are going to do the right thing and have the power to do things they will not. We have to decide that the power has to be with proactive, progressive people at the grassroots level and empower them with information. And the key is information that is credible, that will stand the test of litigation and scrutiny, that has scholarship to back it up, but is also explosive. And we'll give talking information and arguing information and debating information to individual lay people who otherwise wouldn't know how to present themselves to take this information in and use it how they choose. In that regard, on Monday of this coming week, we are launching a new information vaccine information site where we're just giving information so people can use it however they want, including the films. And that is my suggestion to you, because if you get your information out to the lay public and then they start passing it around, then it's their choice after they read it. Do they want a vaccine or not? And I'll tell you how powerful it can be. This past year, when we testified in Albany on the steps and then over New Jersey, we did articles that went viral. And the articles were picked up by 155,000 blogs. And some of those blogs have over a million listeners or readers.
Mm-hmm.
We went from about 10% rejecting the vaccine in Europe to 90%, mainly the doctors and the nurses who read the literature. So we believe that you have to have a movement from the ground up, and you have to be very careful about allowing some of these other vaccine and autism groups to take your information and bury it in theirs where nothing changes. Your thoughts, please.
Well, my thoughts are your thoughts. I mean, I was just speaking to Richard about this. You see, even though I was doing this all year, you know, doing these statistics and everything, and made the presentation, I usually don't do that. I don't go to Congress anymore. I don't do the FDA. I don't do that. I'm totally on the same page with you. So about Mother's Day, I launched the Student Vaccine Liberation Army. And that whole thing was all about, and it's an amazing site, and it's getting a lot of hits. And the whole thing is about transcending the FDA, transcending Congress, transcending just like exactly what you're saying, but even go one step further. What we're doing is that we actually print it up when we get a donation, and we got $1,000 donation actually from a mailman. Okay, we print up these goth stickers. It's a skull with two cross needles, very goth, with the website www.vaccineliberationarmy.com. And so what happened when we first did this, the people that you're talking about within the inner circle of the movements, of the autism movements, they were furious. They were furious that I would have the audacity to say, to start a student revolution, okay, to start a revolution that would be actually called the Vaccine Liberation Army, okay, that I'd be so aggressive. Like, how could they get along with the FDA and the CDC if I was going to be that aggressive and it would look bad for them? You know, and they try to kill it several times. You know, I was trying to, like, move through the environment, you know, get whatever support I could get, and I noticed they were trying to kill it. So I took my baby back and said, I'll do it myself, and I'll completely, you know, stand clear of any kind of negative influence. And the other thing they were upset about was the logo, which was the skull and crossbones with the two vaccine needles, which was basically recommended to me by the students. Well, so I just continue to do it. I printed up these stickers. They come in rolls of 500. I've got activists all over the country. It's just starting now, and it's quite, we did about 12 rolls. That's about 6,000. I don't know, we've done about 15,000 stickers already. We have activists going to the high schools and going to the middle schools. Forget the parents, you know, 'cause you're going to do the parents. I'm not doing the parents. I'm doing only the kids. And we give these kids these stickers, and they not only want one, they want five. It's like a food frenzy. They just love these stickers. So the strategy was, you know, I'm not going to give out any information, you know, like handouts or anything, because that's always rejected. I'm giving out these fabulous stickers. So it's been really working, and these kids go to the website, you know, vaccineliberationarmy.com, and they see there's a lot of videos. It's very compelling, a lot of videos. I like the videos. And then I have some research and documentation room that I put up. And so what's happening is that we have actually street teams, rather than randomly think that somebody's going to go to the going to the internet, we have street teams going right to the teenagers. So I was telling, you know, mentioning this to Richard, and he was telling me about your idea, and I said, yeah, I want to put your initiative that's going to be towards the parents, going to be towards this gal in the middle of Fairfield, nowhere, Iowa, who wants to go into their library with a PowerPoint presentation that you have made and with the documentation that you have, and make it really simple and give a lecture in her community. Because that's what happens. They just, what they do is they for free, they get to the library for an hour, and then they take posters in all these little towns all over the Midwest. They put posters up, and that's why you should have a poster too, you know, sort of a generic poster. They put these posters up around town saying that there's going to be a lecture at the library, you know, Gary Null, blah, blah, blah. And, yeah, I'm with you totally 100%.
Okay, now, Eileen, here's another thing. It took a long time, and, but it was necessary. You have to ask a basic question. Are vaccines safe? If so, what is the proof? And if they're not safe, what is the proof? And that is the whole basis upon which all the other arguments are going to fall. Now, that took almost 3 years. And I had to do the research. I brought in Dr. Dorothy Smith, a research scholar from Cornell. I brought in Dr. Martin Feldman. There were a bunch of individuals who each took different categories. Richard Gale, our scholar in residence, and we all did our research. It took us over a year and a half. But at the end of that time, looking completely objectively, there could be no bias. We had to have a gold standard. In other words, if there was a study showing that the measles vaccine was safe and effective, because you have to have effective as well, for any given individual, then what is that evidence? And once we put it all together, we were appalled by what we found.
Mm-hmm.
There are no double-blind, randomized, placebo-controlled studies. For example, you don't have a group of children who've never been vaccinated and then monitored for 6 years against an equal number of individuals who have been given their full vaccines for the same 6 years and monitored regularly.
Simple.
It's very simple. Then you've never had a group that has been given a placebo and thinking they got the vaccine and monitored as a third
group.
Okay. And then a fourth group given a high-potency natural immune modification diet, like with vitamin D and the elimination of certain things we know are pro-inflammatory, immunosuppressive. So to do it right, you have to have four variables. That's never been done. Mm-mm. There's also never been a test taken ever, a study showing what happens when you give a given child a group of vaccines, up to 36 vaccines over a six-year period, and then monitor their blood chemistry and their natural immune responses per year. It's never been done. Uh-uh. In fact, what we found was the sloppiness. If giving a very small number of people, and sometimes as little as 50 people, the vaccine, and if anyone developed adverse effects during the first part of that vaccine, they were excluded from the trial.
Exactly.
If a woman, for example, developed a fever of 102 within the first 72 hours of getting the vaccine, she was excluded.
Right.
But hello, what is one of the indications that the vaccine is harmful? A fever of 102 within the first 72 hours. So the very thing that they would say would be harmful, they excluded. Then they excluded women, and you got to read the fine print. They exclude people who may be on antipsychotics or antidepressants or selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors or diuretics or any form of heart medication or cancer medication or anti-inflammatory medication, COX-2 inhibitors. You're looking at 50% of the American population, adult population right there.
You know, also, I blew the whistle on that when they did the H1N1, they had all this criteria that was excluding 50% of the population, anybody with a heart condition, anybody, you know, drank alcohol, anybody that had any drugs. I'm totally with you. It's totally skewed. But I want to emphasize your point, though, that is, you know, in your films where it showed the, you know, the downtrodden, this has to be an emotion, and as well as being, you know, the critical data that you're collecting, it also has to be an emotional campaign. It's you know, those photographs that you have and the film that you have, you know, on Vaccine Liberation Army, you know, I have documentation. I'm putting more documentation. There's about 230 posts, but I'm keeping with an emotional content, because these kids are the only way that's ever been a revolution anywhere, probably in the world, has been with students. And when these kids, you know, who don't want to get a vaccinated, you see, the interesting thing about parents, they've already been, you know, programmed to the fact that vaccines may be safe and effective. So you got to get over that hump. With the children, they don't want to get vaccinated. So this actually gives them fodder to work on. The other thing is that once one or two of them decide, I'm not going to get vaccinated, they begin to educate their parents. And then the question's going to be, it's an interesting question, the question's going to be, does a 12-year-old, 13-year-old, 14-year-old, 15-year-old, do they have the right to get their own religious exemption? Or, if the parents disagree with them, like, who trumps who? Do we have personal sovereignty at the age of 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18? You know, it's going to be an interesting conversation.
Adults don't care. Our future is not with the seniors. They're gone.
Right,
with
exactly.
Rare exception. It's not with the baby boomers. They're too lazy and into their selfish lifestyle. It's not with the 30 and 40-year-olds. They're clueless and they're so confused about everything. It's for the younger people.
Right.
The future is going to be when people get so angry about what they see as the truth that has been denied them and hidden from them and manipulated and exploiting them, that they're going to stand up and say no more. That's where you're going to have it, just like in the Vietnam War. You may have certain individuals from all other groups as representative, but the bulk of people are going to have to come from this, because now we can say unequivocally there is no good science proving the safety and efficacy of vaccines individually or collectively for any given individual. And if they say, well, that's not true, then I will show them their own studies of fully vaccinated groups for measles coming down with measles in a more violent form. Fully vaccinated group with a whooping cough coming down. A fully vaccinated group with influenza coming down with it, and or no efficacy at all for seniors, but why give it then when we know that no vaccine is inert?
Now, I hope you can make it, like, simple. Like, I'm thinking, you know, like in a community where I visit a lot, like Fairfield, Iowa, which is an enlightened community of 100,000 people, oh, I mean 10,000 people that meditate, but they have this little thing where, you know, you want to do something, you rent the library for free for, you know, an hour or two, and you put the posters up. And so, you know, to get to that grassroots level, I'm thinking with whatever you do, because you are so, like, you've got volumes and volumes and volumes of research and amazing stuff, that there's a package that you present that's really simple, that they can actually refer to deeper knowledge if they want.
It's starting.
Yeah.
I've worked 4 years on a series of films. I'm out filming now. We just finished filming in India, Dr. Shiva and many others there.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's hard to imagine what you don't know until you're in a place and suddenly you see what no one could possibly believe. Imagine 750 million people in India don't have toilets.
Yes, I've been to India.
I mean, they have to go outside. You're talking about a 2.5 times population in the United States defecating 2 or 3 times a day outside in water. There is no clean water. It's all black and methane loaded. It's the ground everywhere you walk. You have to watch on the streets. And yet never once is this discussed as a public health issue or public health crisis.
But, Gary, you don't need to clean the water. You can just, or get toilets. You can just give them a vaccine.
Well, that's what we should do to members of Congress. But anyhow, what's coming in the next 4 weeks is the total culmination of all this. It's a major feature film. It's called Death by Medicine.
Great, yeah.
And as I'm away right now finishing filming on the sequel to Drugging of Our Children, Pathologizing Our Youth, so that they can medicate them, we are finishing our film, our editing in New York and getting it ready for test screening. This becomes the progenitor. This is the foundation, because once you see this, you see how you've been lied to and manipulated about everything. And by the way, all the people in the film are board certified physicians, over 90 of them, from all walks of life, from the schools they consider their pristine schools, talking out against what goes on that doesn't get discussed at the lay level or in the media. Anyhow, if you continue your campaign, Eileen, of doing what you're doing and reaching out to the youth and bypassing all these institutions within the autism and vaccine movement and going directly to the youth, you will make an impact unlike anyone has made in this movement. And that's what we need. Bypass the doctors, bypass Congress, because they're not going to do anything. They've had more than an ample opportunity. They've had all the information. They have hearings galore. They have done nothing. Look at Representative Burton.
Yeah.
He did the best hearings in the history of Congress on autism because his own grandson, has autism.
Right.
Now, I had a chance to interview Beth Clay.
Right.
And she said that they proved under oath that there was perjury, there was hiding information, there were lies constantly by the CDC and the pharmaceutical industry, yet nothing happened. After all that hearing, 2.5 years of work on that, she said it ended up being zero effect.
Well, do you know what? No, actually, do you know what really happened? What really happened was while Burton, and of course I think he was demoted also besides that, off his committees, but with Burton and with Dave Weldon, I guess, who left eventually. But you know what? Interesting what they did was that it was so powerful, really, everything that everybody was doing at the time, even though it didn't look that good, that the CDC, without a bill or a law, without being embarrassed by a passage or consideration of the Weldon law, okay, Weldon bill, they actually took thimerosal out of the vaccines without the fanfare. So it really did work.
But the trouble is they didn't take it out of the vaccines because they allowed trace elements in the vaccines.
Right. But anyway, they do, you know, basically,
and
yes,
it's
a little
flu
trace
vaccine.
Elements. Yeah, because they didn't change the process, right? But
so
still,
if you don't
I think
process,
that even though
still
it appears to be ineffective in a very clean kind of way, the reality is they did take it out of the vaccines to a point, but they had their strategy to put it back into the flu shot, of which they will ultimately mandate it from 6 months old through 18 years old. That means the 15 thimerosal shots that were in the vaccines before Burton and Weldon did their thing, the children got 15 thimerosal shots, you know, before the age of 6, but now they took that out more or less, except for their trace, you know, as you point out, but not all of them, but some of them. But They now have it in the flu shot at 25 mcg levels, of which they're recommending from 6 months old through 19. That means 20 injections of mercury. 20, more than 15.
So they still get the same number of vaccines.
They have more.
And so it gets the child right back to where we are.
Exactly.
So we have to have people simply say, I know the truth and I'm acting on it. And it's got to be the people who have not yet been compromised by their standard of living or by the body politic. And that's the reason we have to be on top of this. Eileen, thank you very much. Give your website and give your contact information.
Okay. After this conversation, I would give the website of the statistics of the H1N1, the 3,000 miscarriages. That's on progressiveconvergence.com. But the real deal here, as Gary pointed out here, is the Vaccine Liberation Army. .com. Join the army, and we'll talk about putting your initiative up there as well.
Thank you. Eileen, I look forward to our next conversation.
Me too.
All the best to you.
All the best to you.
Eileen Dannemann, D-A-N-N-E-M-A-N-N. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take calls now. You have a chance now to call in to the Progressive Radio Network and share your points of view, your thoughts with us. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. And this is empowering information. Sometimes even the truth that we didn't know about or didn't want to hear about is very liberating. It allows us the chance to make an informed choice. Back in a moment.
City. It's the Gary Nall Show. And now, your host, Gary Nall.
I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Nall. We have a half hour to go. I want to open our call lines up so you have a chance to share your thoughts and insights and opinions on any of the issues that are important. This ties in with our discussion just now. The World Health Organization, according to Jonathan Benson, is at it again trying to push mass vaccination, this time on the people of China. But its efforts to eradicate measles by vaccinating 100 million Chinese children have fueled widespread protests by Chinese citizens who not only distrust their own government's health recommendations, but also believe that the vaccines are dangerous. According to the Boston Globe, the Chinese government recently announced a 10-day measles immunization drive that sparked an outcry from concerned citizens over the safety of the vaccines. And they're saying no to them. We'll take some calls whenever you decide to call in here. In the interim, I'll take some of the latest on health and nutrition information. I mentioned earlier a commentary from Jim Goodman on the food crisis is not about a shortage of food, and I thought you would find this of interest. And it's short. It says, the food crisis never really ended. It was ignored and forgotten. The rich and powerful are well fed. They had no food crisis, no shortage. So in the West, it was little more than a short-lived soundbite, tragic but forgettable. To the poor in the developing world, whose ability to afford food is no better now than it was in 2008, the hunger continues. Hunger can have many contributing factors: natural disaster, discrimination, war, poor infrastructure. So why, regardless of the situation, is high-tech agriculture always assumed to be the only solution? This premise is put forward and supported by those who would benefit financially if their solution were implemented. Corporations peddle their high-technology genetically engineered seed and chemical packages, their genetically altered animals, always with the promise of feeding the world. Politicians and philanthropists who may mean well jump on the high-technology bandwagon. Could the promise of financial support or investment return fuel their apparent compassion? The Alliance for Green Revolution in Africa, or AGRA, an initiative of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the Rockefeller Foundation, supposedly works to achieve a food-secure and prosperous Africa. While these sentiments and goals may be philanthropic, some of the coalition partners have a different agenda. One of the key players in AGRA is Monsanto, and they hope to spread its genetically engineered seed throughout Africa by promising better yields, drought resistance, an end to hunger, etc. Could a new green revolution succeed where the old green revolution had failed? Or was the whole concept of a green revolution a pig in a poke to begin with? Monsanto giving free seed to poor smallholder farmers sounds great. Or are they just setting the hook? Remember, the next year those farmers will have to buy their seed. Interesting to note that the Gates Foundation purchased $23 million worth of Monsanto stock in the second quarter of this year. Do they also see the food crisis in Africa as a potential to turn a nice profit? Every corporation has one overriding interest, self-interest, but surely not charitable foundations. Food shortages are seldom about a lack of food. There's plenty of food in the world. The shortages occur because of the inability to get food where it is needed and the inability of the hungry to afford it. These two problems are principally caused by, well, a lack of justice. There's also ethical considerations. A higher value should be placed on people than on corporate profit, but it's not. In 2008, there were shortages of food in some places for some people. There was never a shortage of food in 2008 on a global basis, nor is there currently. True, some countries in Africa, for example, do not have enough food where it is needed, yet people with money have their fill no matter where they live. Poverty and inequality cause hunger. The current food riots in Mozambique were a result of increased wheat prices on the world market. The UN Food and Agriculture Organization estimates the world is on course to the third largest wheat harvest in history, so increasing wheat prices were not caused by actual shortages, but rather by speculation on the price of wheat in the international market. And while millions of people go hungry in India, thousands of kilos of grain rot in storage. Unable to afford the grain, the hungry depend upon the government to distribute food, and apparently that's not going so well. Not everyone living in a poor country goes hungry. Those with money eat. Not everyone living in a rich country is well fed. Those without money go hungry. We in the United States are said to have the safest, most abundant food supply in the world. Yet even here, surrounded by an overabundance of food, there are plenty of hungry people, and their numbers are growing. Do we, too, have a food crisis concurrent with an obesity crisis? Why is there widespread hunger? Is food a right? Is profit-taking through speculation that drives food prices out of the reach of the poor a right? Is pushing high-technology agriculture on an entire continent that could feed itself a corporate right? In developing countries, those with hunger and poor food distribution to small farmers, most of whom are women, have little say in agricultural policy. The framework of international trade and the rules imposed by the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank on developing countries places emphasis on crops for export, not crops for feeding a hungry population. Despite what we hope are the best of intentions of the Gates Foundation, the new green revolution based on genetically engineered crops, imported fertilizer, and government-imposed agricultural policy will not feed the world. Women, not Monsanto, feed most of the world's population. The greatest portion of the world's diet still relies on crops and farming systems developed and cultivated by the indigenous for centuries. Systems that still work, systems that offer real promise. The report of 400 experts from around the world, the International Assessment of Agricultural Science and Technology for Development, is ignored by the proponents of the New Green Revolution, precisely because it shows that the best hope for ending hunger lies with local, traditional, farmer-controlled agriculture production, not high-tech industrial agriculture. To feed the world, fair methods of land distribution must be considered. A fair and just food system depends on smallholder farmers having access to land. The function of a just farm system is to ensure that everyone gets to eat. Industrial agriculture functions to ensure corporations controlling the systems make a profit. The ultimate cause of hunger is not a lack of Western agricultural technology. Rather, hunger results when people are not allowed to participate in a food system of their choosing. Civil wars, structural adjustment policies, inadequate distribution systems, international commodity speculation, and corporate control of food from seed to table, these are the causes of hunger, the stimulus for food crisis. If the Gates Foundation is serious about ending hunger in Africa, they need to read that report, not Monsanto's quarterly profit report. Then they can decide how their money must be spent. Jim Goodman is a dairy farmer and an activist in Wisconsin. I'm Gary Nall. We're here to talk about the issues. If you have comments, questions, your opportunity to call in, our number, 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. And I will be on the radio Sunday night, live, with my satellite little mini mic, being able to broadcast. What's nice is no matter where I'm at, I'm able to broadcast based upon the technology of minimalizing the station. It used to be a big, what was called an ISDN box and a Comrex. Now it's just something that fits in a small little bag. So I'll wait for your calls now. Hopefully you'll call in. And this, I'm sure you've all been listening to these people talk about this woman, this conservative Green Party, Christine McDonald's win over there against the incumbent. Well, here's what you probably didn't hear. Dateline Wilmington, the Borowitz Report, galvanized by Republican senatorial nominee Christine O'Donnell's anti-masturbation stance. Yes, she has one. Masturbators from across the state converged on Wilmington today in what some are calling the largest pro-wanking protest in American history. Carrying signs reading, "O'Donnell hands off our masturbation," the angry masturbators clogged downtown Wilmington, stopping traffic for blocks. Harley Farger, a leading Delaware masturbator and planner of the Million Masturbators March, said it was difficult to organize masturbators because they are used to acting alone. Mr. Farger, the executive director of the pro-monkey spanking group Master Nation, said that the wank and foul of his organization believe that masturbation is an inalienable right guaranteed by the Constitution. Quote, "Our country was founded by rugged individuals, and you know what rugged individuals like to do," he said. He said that Ms. McDonald's anti-whacking position was ill-timed, adding, "In this economy, masturbation is one of the few simple pleasures people can still afford." Tracy Klugan, a homemaker and masturbator from Dover, Delaware, said she's puzzled by what she sees as the contradictory nature of candidate O'Donnell's position. "If you're against masturbation, why would you want to serve in Congress?" A spokesman for the Wilmington Police Department said that the Million Masturbators March will cost the city tens of thousands of dollars, especially when you include the cost of cleaning up afterwards. I'm Gary Nall. And by the way, coming up after this show in about 19 minutes will be our Washington lawyer who will be here, James Turner, on Consuming Interest is the name of his program. Now, before I go to another commentary, which I'm happy to do, I've got a lot of them and a lot to share with you. It's your turn to call in. If you have something to share, questions, please do so. Happy to hear from you. And now we'll take on some of the serious issues. Poor sanitation and water shortages and climate change and environmental destruction, according to John Vidal of The Guardian, this is what we face. I'll quote this. It's a very interesting commentary. It's not that long. Salakellen, 40 miles outside of Kabul, looks like a rural paradise at harvest time. Women and children play behind a wall made of mud. The men thresh wheat, teenagers pick walnuts, and water comes straight off the snowy mountains high above the village, gurgling through the irrigation canals. But the rural ideal hides conflict, deep poverty, and growing environmental degradation. Most families here say that they have been uprooted by war in the last 20 years, and the climate change means the seasons have become shorter. Also, the population has grown so much, there's not enough land to grow food for everyone. On top of that, they say the water's polluted and now is a source of conflict. Quote, we can't earn nearly enough. Compared to 20 years ago, we're now much poorer. We have new crop diseases we cannot treat. There's conflict between the herders and the settled farmers, and people are cutting down the forest for fuel, so says a village elder. The problems mirror those seen all over Afghanistan, and the prospects of this war-torn, hungry country getting anywhere near meeting its development goals, which covers water, sanitation, and environment, is zero in the next decade or longer. Afghanistan is just one of the poorest countries in the world. It has some of the worst human development indicators comparable to Sierra Leone and Angola. Its development has been tied closely to conflict for decades, and it's only signaled the Millennium Declaration. Since then, the situation has worsened. Millions of people have flooded into the capital, either to escape conflict or increasingly to find work and food. The city, with an estimated 5 million people, is believed to be the fastest-growing capital in the world, and new illegal shanty towns creep up and over the hillsides every year. More than 75% of the whole of urban Afghan population live without water, electricity, or secure ownership. In Kabul, the figure is much higher. So why don't we hear that when we hear about how well we're doing in Afghanistan? From Michael Hudson, from Global Research, I can smell the newly giveaway looming a mile off. The Wall Street bailout health insurance giveaway and support of real estate prices rather than mortgage debt write-downs were bad enough, not to mention the oil wars extension in Afghanistan and Iraq. But now comes a topper, the $50 billion transportation infrastructure plan that Obama proposed in Milwaukee, cynically enough, on Labor Day. It looks like a Thatcherite public-private partnership. Now, what does this mean in lay language? Well, I suggested, and you will see this in the new stimulus proposal I'm writing up that will be up next week, that we take everyone's mortgage in the United States and rewrite it based upon what the current value, market value is. So let's say that you have a home that you paid $100,000 for, and it went up to $200,000, and you borrowed against it. But now it's worth $70,000, and you cannot afford the mortgage payments and the interest, and you're going to walk away from it, or it's going to be foreclosed on you. I would suggest that the government, working with the banks, simply rewrite the mortgage at $75,000, lowering the interest, forgiving late fees and penalties, and dropping the interest down to 2%. A, that gives the bank at least an income. B, it allows the bank to write off against future earnings any loss. C, it allows a person to stay in their home, which allows them not to become homeless and a burden upon others. It's reasonable. Now, what Michael Hudson's saying is that Obama and Geithner and the people around him came up with the idea of giving $50 billion to banks so they, in turn, could make it available to those who qualify. No, that means the banks are the ones who are going to be making the money, and that's just not right. It's not going to work. Nothing they've done has worked, so they shouldn't even be going there. It's just foolish. And also, this is from Marjorie Cohen, Business as Usual in Iraq, commondreams.org. Quote, President Obama ceremoniously announced that U.S. combat operations has ended in Iraq. As Democrats face an uphill battle in the upcoming midterm elections, Obama felt he had to make good on his campaign promise to move the fighting from Iraq to Afghanistan. But while he has escalated the killing in Afghanistan, it's business as usual in Iraq. Here's the story Americans are not aware of. The United States, with its huge embassy in Baghdad and 5 large bases and 89 smaller bases throughout Iraq, will continue to pull the strings there. Last week, Vice President Biden delivered a power-sharing plan to the Iraqis, who have been unable to form a government in the 6 months since the March elections resulted in a stalemate. He says, we think that that's better for the future of Iraq, so said Biden. the Americans can close the deal. Well, the timing of Obama's announcement the combat troops are leaving Iraq is based on status of forces agreement of the Bush administration's negotiation. We're going to have 50,000 military staying in Iraq, 4,500 U.S. Special Forces troops will continue to fight and kill with Iraqi Special Forces. American troops are still authorized to take preemptive action against any threat they perceive. The policy regarding airstrikes and bombings will remain unchanged, and untold numbers of civilian contractors, more accurately called mercenaries, will stay in Iraq unaccountable for their war crimes. When Obama spoke to the nation about ending combat operations in Iraq, he delivered his message with a spin that would make George Bush proud. Obama renamed the U.S. occupation in Iraq Operation New Dawn and talked of the sacrifices we made during Operation Iraqi Freedom, but he failed to mention that the more than 100,000 dead Iraqis, the untold numbers of wounded Iraqis, the 2 million Iraqis who went into exile. He said nothing about the few hours a day that most Iraqis enjoy electricity. He neglected to note that unions have been outlawed and Iraq's infrastructure is in shambles. He omitted any reference to the illegality of Bush's war of aggression in violation of the UN Charter and Bush's policy of torture and abuse of Iraq in violation of the Geneva Convention. Obama's chose instead to praise his predecessor, saying, quote, "No one could doubt Bush's commitment to our security," unquote. But foreign occupation of Iraq and mistreatment of prisoners never made us more secure. Obama also failed to remind us that we went to war based on two lies by the Bush administration, that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction and that al-Qaeda was in bed with Saddam Hussein. Obama spoke of credible elections in Iraq. But, quote, "Iraq does not have a functional democracy," so said Ray Geyer, Iraq consultant for American Friends Service Committee and a senior fellow at Peace Action. Quote, "We cannot expect to have a functional democracy from Iraq that was imposed by foreign occupation. The new Iraqi state is among the most corrupt in the world," so said journalist Nir Rosen, writing in Foreign Policy, quote, "It is only effective at being brutal and providing a minimum level of security. It fails to provide adequate services to its people, millions of whom are barely able to survive. Iraqis are traumatized. Every day there are assassinations with silenced pistols and the small magnetic car bombs known as sticky bombs," unquote. Obama put the cost of the war at $3 trillion. An awesome sum that could well be used to provide universal health care, quality education, and improve infrastructure to create jobs in this country. But he overlooked the cost of treating our disabled veterans, many of whom return with traumatic brain injury and post-traumatic stress disorder. Quote, "There is no question that the Iraqi war added substantially to the federal debt," says Joseph Stiglitz in the Washington Post. "The global financial crisis was due at least in part to the war." Well, regardless of how Obama tries to spin his message about the disaster the United States has created in Iraq, 60% of Americans think the U.S. invasion of Iraq was a mistake. 70% of Americans believe it wasn't worth sacrificing American lives, and only one quarter feel it made it safer. The majority of Iraqis also oppose the U.S. occupation. As I ponder events unfolding in Iraq and Obama's efforts to explain them to us, I'm reminded of the highly decorated Marine Corps General Smedley Butler. Nearly 70 years ago, he declared, quote, "War is a racket." He was referring to the use of Marines in Central America during the early 20th century to protect U.S. corporations like United Fruit, which were exploiting agricultural resources in that region. In my view, the Iraqi war had a similar purpose, to secure the rich Iraqi oil fields and make them available to corporations that will continue to feed America's petroleum addiction. In a more honest speech, Obama would have said, "We successfully removed a leader who was unfriendly to American geopolitical and economic interests and replaced him with people beholden to U.S. money and material. U.S. forces have been downsized and rebranded. The enduring presence post new nomenclature for U.S. bases in Iraq will ensure that we maintain our power in Iraq. Mission accomplished." Marjorie Cohn is a professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and past president of the National Lawyers Guild. I'm Gary Nall, and we're up to the last 7 minutes, your final opportunity to call in and ask questions, share your thoughts. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888 if you'd like to do so. And while you're thinking about that, a couple more things I have here. On the food safety threat, this is from one of the activist groups out there. I'll quote it. A new, brand new bill has just been introduced in the Senate. It's supposed to hold accountable those who taint our food supply on purpose. But as drafted, it actually gives license to the FDA to target supplement and natural food product companies. Please take action today. This new bill is on top of the House and Senate food safety bills that we have been updating you about for some time. Please keep in mind the truth about all these bills. There are already laws on the books to ensure the safety of our food. All we need do is to enforce them. Instead, for the past 2 years, lawmakers have been trying to beef up current laws. The main vehicle for this effort has been something called Food Safety Enhancement Act, and the House version of this bill, H.R. 2749, passed at the end of July 2009. And we are opposed to it. It is a travesty. It would not only impose draconian new penalties, including long jail terms, on both food and supplement producers who even inadvertently fail to follow FDA bookkeeping rules to the letter, a provision clearly intended for use in intimidating smaller producers. It also places undue economic hardship on small, mid-sized farms and food facilities, both organic and conventional. And the Senate version of the bill, S-510, introduced in March of 2009, was passed out of committee, but an agreement has not been reached to bring it to the floor of the Senate for a vote. Now comes Food Safety Accountability Act, S-3767. That's S-3767, and introduced by Senator Patrick Leahy, Democrat of Vermont. This new Senate bill appears to use language similar to the language found in the dreadful House bill. It increases criminal penalties to 10 years imprisonment for any person who knowingly introduces or delivers for introduction into interstate commerce any food that is adulterated or misbranded, or for any person to adulterate or misbrand any food in interstate commerce. But because the terms misbranded and adulterated are very broadly defined, such a law would, for example, hold companies liable if one of the supplements they carry cites peer-reviewed science about the benefits of a supplement. The same goes for even minor record-keeping violations. The law would say the company had, quote, knowingly introduced a product in interstate commerce when they offered it for sale, even if they didn't know there were record-keeping mistakes associated with a supplement. Here's the crazy part. This bill would not necessarily hold accountable a company that tainted a product even on purpose if this type of adulteration occurred before the product was sold by a distributor. The FDA has a long history of targeting natural health product companies under false pretenses. This is what happened to a group of cherry producers that cited Harvard research about the benefits of cherries on their website. The FDA forced them to sign a consent decree so burdensome that it almost put them out of business. With the bigger threat of increased criminal penalties, FDA would practically have free rein. So, that's where we're at now, and I'm very concerned about that. We will have this up on GaryNoll.com. Let's just say hello. I'm just looking at the time now. We're out of time. Sorry, now it's too late. Now we got a whole lot of people online. We got 20 people wanting to ask something. Where were you for the last hour? I gave you a chance. Well, you'll have a chance on Sunday night to call in, because the whole hour will be devoted to talking about the issues that are important to you. And as we leave out of here today, let me just remind you that more and more information and articles every day go up on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and GaryNoll.com. Tell a friend that there is a place that it's empowering. Come to it and listen. Listen to all the different ideas that are being given out. See if any of those ideas make sense. If they make sense, use them. Share them. If they don't, well, then don't. But at least you'll know that there'll be more tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone. I look forward to seeing you back here on Sunday evening.
The Gary Knoll Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Carol Lee. Thank you.